Thank you for the offertory music, very special music, runs in my blood. Exodus. Preliminary count is 96. That's the most we've ever had in this room, so that's really good. Over the years, some parents have played a game with their younger children to name the opposite, such as hot would be cold, or summer would be winter, and you know, maybe small would be big or large. And then there's the profound opposites as well. War would be peace. So what would the opposite be for pride and vanity? Pride or vanity, what would that be? And the answer we've already heard it touched on, and that is humility. Now it's interesting how the Apostle Paul introduces the days of unleavened bread in 1 Corinthians 5. 1 Corinthians 5, starting in verse 6. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 6. Your glorying is not good. This is to the church. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Now, I want to read something from Gill's exposition of the Bible on this particular verse. It's kind of, again, quite profound what is stated here from Gill's exposition of the Bible. Their glorying in their outward flourishing condition was in their riches and in their wealth, in their wisdom, and that their glorying was in the sin itself that was going on. Their connivance at it, they more or less supported it. It was far from being good. It was criminal, as the consequence of it was dangerous. And that was from that particular commentary. And then we find a question. We find a question. And notice that, don't you know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? All it takes is a little bit. A little bit of pride, a little bit of vanity, and the whole is leavened. So what were they to do? What are we to do? Therefore, purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, since you are truly unleavened, for indeed Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us. And we kept that on Tuesday evening, the ceremony of the death of Jesus Christ, a remembrance of it. And of course, he did die for us, for our sins. Therefore, verse 8, let's keep the feast. This is referring to the days of unleavened bread. To keep the feast, not with the old leaven. So here we see that leaven is likened to glorying. Because your glorying is not good. Therefore, get rid of this old leaven, and then we need to keep the feast. According to the NAS commentary, the Greek word for glorying means to boast about, to be proud, to have a reason to be proud. So our pride or our glorying, our boasting is not good, and it spreads like leaven in dough. So leavening is a very good example of what pride does. It grows. And it's interesting when we are looking at the context here in Corinthians as to why God chose us to have us put out leaven and abstain it from it for 7 days. And we see the command over here in Exodus 13. Exodus 13. Of course, in the sermonette, we heard Exodus 12 being read. And it's reiterated again in the next chapter. Exodus 13, let's start verse 3. Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. For by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. On this day you're going out in the month of Abib. And it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month." Even in the promised land, they were to keep it as a memorial, as a reminder of what God did for them. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there will be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days. No leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And so it goes on. And you shall tell your son. So this is a responsibility for parents, for grandparents. Tell your son in that day, saying, "This is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. It will be a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. Therefore you will keep this ordinance in its season from year to year." So as we heard, it is a command. It is a command. The abstaining from leaven is a physical reminder of what God did. They didn't do it on their own. They didn't leave on their own. They had to have help. It was by God's power, and therefore they were always to be in awe and respect of God. But it also carries a spiritual lesson, and that is that God is greater than any of us, and that God is to be honored. And so we remove pride, and we live by humility. Let's notice this instruction by Jesus in one of the parables he gave in Luke 18. Luke 18. Luke 18. Starting in verse 9. "And he spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves, that they were righteous and they despised others. They looked down upon others and they felt they were just great. They gloried in themselves. So two men went to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee and one was a tax collector." And again, this is a story. So he's presenting this story. "The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, 'God, I thank you. I'm not like other men. I'm not an extortioner. I'm not unjust. I'm not like this tax collector. I actually fast twice in a week. I give tithes of all that I possess.' But the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but rather he beat himself and said, 'God,' beat his breast and said, 'God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted.'" And so even we find a story, a parable that Jesus Christ showed us. I don't think we would have understood the connection between leaven and pride with any other ingredient. For instance, let's say we were told, "Let's get rid of sugar out of our lives for the next 7 days." Well, how are we going to do that? And what does sugar represent? I mean, it's sweet, and you get too much of it, it's sickeningly sweet. But let's get rid of cream. How about cream? Well, what lesson would that have? Or even salt. Salt has some good metaphors with that. What does salt mean? But what does salt do? It seasons. It's leaven. The ingredient that we put out is leaven. God says to get rid of it out of our homes, to partake of unleavened bread. And spiritually, in our minds, we got to do the same thing. We got to remove the pride and the vanity that is there and replace it with humility. Now, we see this in principle in 1 Peter 5 and verse 5. Let's look at 1 Peter 5 and verse 5. 1 Peter 5 and in verse 5. Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. And then he goes on to say, yes, all of you, be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. He resists. Be submissive. Be clothed with humility. A fellow by the name of Pat Williams, in his book, he authored the book called Humility, The Secret Ingredient of Success. This is what he wrote. He said that humility is a choice, and so is arrogance. He went on to say that the wild beast of arrogance always lurks within us. And we can only be, and that can only be subdued by a more powerful and spiritual force. And that's the character strength of humility. And he went on to say, he said, we must continually choose an attitude of humility, or we will choose arrogance by default. You know, the default program goes to arrogance. So we must choose the attitude of humility. We know that's what we're to do. We read the scriptures about it. We see right here to be clothed with it. We're to put it on as if we're putting on our clothes. That has to be part of us. But how do we do it? How do we practically do that every single day of our lives? How do we choose, or how do we strive for humility? And that's the title of the sermon, Striving for Humility. We could go through dozens and dozens of scriptures that tell us the dangers of pride and the need to have humility. But let's look at three of those in Proverbs. So let's start with Proverbs 11 and in verse 2. Proverbs 11 and verse 2. Proverbs 11 and in verse 2. When pride comes, then comes shame. But with the humble is wisdom. The Sansino commentary, again, it's a Jewish commentary. It paraphrases this particular verse. And it says this. Pride is better stated here as arrogance, and shame means contempt. So you could also say, when arrogance comes, then comes contempt. That's one way of looking at it. They go on to say that the root word here for humble, being humble, comes from the same root word found in Micah 6 and verse 8. We won't turn to Micah 6 verse 8, but that's the scripture that says, "What does the Lord require of you but to walk humbly?" Same root word. It refers to walking humbly with God. But with the humble is wisdom. Walking with God is humility. There's a Jewish proverb that actually is based on this verse. And so this proverb goes as water leaves a high level. And it always goes to a lower level, from a high level to a lower level. So the Torah, meaning the law, abandons him whose mind is haughty. If his mind is haughty, the Torah leaves him, and it only cleaves to those whose mind is humble. So that if you're up high, God's law isn't there guiding you. But if you're humble, the law will be there. Let's look at Proverbs 22, verse 4. Proverbs 22 and verse 4. Proverbs 22, verse 4. By humility and the fear of the Lord are riches and honor and life. So again, I'm reading from the Sansino commentary that the word for humility means the absence of pride. So if we have the absence of pride and we fear God, there will be riches and honor and life. And we know God gives us so many spiritual riches. You know, thinking about what we were able to do on Tuesday night and what we were able to do last night and here today. These are laws of God, but they're very beneficial for all of us. It's very encouraging for all of us. And then notice Proverbs 18. Proverbs 18 and in verse 12. It says, "Before destruction, the heart of a man is haughty, and before honor is humility." Now, this is an interesting verse, because what this verse does is combine, it's a combination of two other proverbs. And so this verse combines, again, we don't need to turn there, but Proverbs 16:18 says, "Pride goes before destruction." And Proverbs 15, verse 23 says, "Before honor is humility." So here we find whoever wrote this particular proverb, and more than likely Solomon, took two proverbs, reworded it somewhat into this proverb here. Before destruction, the heart of man is haughty. Before honor is humility. So back in 2016, that's about 7 years ago, the dean of the Harvard Business School, by the name of Professor Noria, he spoke to the Harvard graduating class that year, in which he addressed humility. So part of his lecture then was posted on the St. Augustine of Florida school system website. And in his lecture, he mentioned three types of humility. And he then took humility, and as he noted here, he said, You break it down into three types. And he said, knowing those types can actually help us to nurture the behavior that we need to incorporate more fully in our lives. So the first one he called was intellectual humility. Intellectual humility. And he went on to say that that's the knowledge that no matter how smart we are, we can always learn from others. He then asked the students, what steps are you taking to intentionally learn from other people? What steps are you taking then to assimilate what you've learned from those teachings into your own life or your own practice? One of the greatest types of pride is intellectual pride. This is where one believes he or she is always right about everything, that no one can tell them any differently. And he or she is the type that is very intellectual. A lot of them are very smart. And they become expert. They're experts in their own opinions on any type of topic. And they'll actually interrupt in a conversation to say what they believe on that particular topic. And I've seen it over the years. You know, for many of you, you already know that I grew up in the church since 1958 and have seen it over the years of those who claimed they had a certain gift of understanding Greek or Hebrew. I go to the local library or wherever on the web and look up all these Greek and Hebrew words and are into their own theological research. And they get off base. I've seen it time and time again. They get off base because they think they are right. And they refuse to consider anyone else's opinion. And it becomes intellectual vanity. And it's like cancer that metastasizes to the bone. Intellectual vanity can be like a metastasis to the mind of my way of thinking. And it becomes so part of them, it becomes part of their lives. And that's what we have to be very careful about. Notice Romans 12, verse 3. Romans 12, verse 3. Romans 12, verse 3. I'll say this, though, that there are some times that you can learn, you know, from someone who is very intelligent. You can, as long as that intelligence is in line with God and His mind. You know, so there might be something that one finds that we hadn't seen before in a particular word or whatever. But as long as that is still in parallel with God's mind, that's great. I say, through the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. So, one way to choose humility, to strive for humility, is to ask ourselves, where are we on the spectrum of intellectuality? Where are we? Is it more toward pride, or is it more toward humility? For an intellectual to be full of humility is rare, but it's also encouraging to be able to be with someone who has a really sharp mind and is very humble. He's very humble. That's where we have to be. We have to be on the spectrum of where the humility is and not off toward pride. Remember, this information was shared with the students, the graduates from Harvard. Now, Harvard is one of the most prestigious universities in the world. If you have a Harvard degree, you've made it into the intellectual world. He was telling those graduates, he was saying, are you willing to recognize that no matter how smart you are, you can always learn from others? That's what he basically was saying. So we need to ask ourselves the question, do we ask for input? Do we ask, you know, our wives or husbands, even our children? Do we ask for suggestions? Do we ask for ideas? Do we get ideas from friends and family? And then if those ideas are in line with God and His laws, do we then incorporate them to take that input and to live our lives that way? That is what we need to be doing. Now, when we've been called into the church, God has opened up our minds to some very great intellectual knowledge. But that intellectual knowledge can't be used to try to put other people down. You know, boy, I just can't believe those people do that. Well, it's because they don't know any better yet. They will be called in the future. This world is going its own way, but they don't know yet the truth of God. They will. But we got to be, well, we'll get into that a little later, but that's the point. We need to make sure we don't think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think, and to be able to recognize that we can learn from others. Now, keep our place in Romans, because we'll be coming back there. But let's look at the type two humility. And what he called it was a moral humility. And he mentioned, this is his statement here, it's the awareness that no matter how self-assured you are about your moral compass, you are vulnerable under stress and in certain contexts, you could lose your way. No matter how self-assured you are of your moral compass, you are vulnerable under stress, and you could lose your way. Are you able to know when to say no when you have to do so? We're very much aware of when to say no. Now, Paul mentions this as a warning in 1 Corinthians 10. So let's go to 1 Corinthians 10. 1 Corinthians 10, and in verse 9. He's talking about what happened to the people back in Israel. And he said, don't tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain, as some of them complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. And all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. I've heard over the years some say, well, I can't believe all those people did that back in 1995. And, well, wait a minute. Except for the grace of God, that could have been us too. And so we've got to be very careful, not to be so self-assured that we fall. Therefore, let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. I believe all of us here know the difference between right and wrong. We all know that. We live in a society, though, that is so much influenced by Hollywood, mainstream media, hedonism, pure pleasure, no matter what the consequences. Be careful lest we think we could never get involved in that or whatever. We could become vulnerable before we know it. Do we get our priorities mixed up? What is our first priority but God? God, his way of life. Our second priority is family, our spouse, our children. Third priority is the church. A fourth priority would be work. God, family, church, work. Where are our priorities? If God is knocked out of that first priority, we are on our own. God helps us to have a good relationship in our family with our spouse and children. God helps us have a good relationship with one another within the church. And God helps us have a very good work ethic on our jobs. But if we neglect God, we can be in the category of, hey, we think we stand, but we could fall. Let me give you an example of what happened. It was a very sad situation. This guy was a local leader in one of the congregations within the Church of God. I mean, he served so much in the church. He was well-loved. He was beloved. He seemed to have a very wonderful family. Well, his job took him overseas. And somewhere in the Caribbean, he met this woman. And that was it. That was it. Left his wife, left his family, left God. It was devastation. And no one would have known that. What went on in his mind? Could it have been? And we don't know, and only God knows, and God is the judge. We don't know. Did his priorities get mixed up? Did God get knocked off of that top priority? And that's only the question he's going to have to make one of these days, and we hope that all works out. But how often has that happened to people? It could happen to us if we're not careful. So no matter how self-assured we are of our moral compass, we have to say no when we need to. We have to set our priority where God is there as our priority. We just have to do it. And so we have to ask ourselves about moral humility. Moral humility. That we could be vulnerable, and we just have to really stay close to God that we aren't. Okay, the third type was what he called personal humility. And he said that's the skill of listening to other people, to recognize the contribution of others, even to accept the praise of other people. But he basically was saying this is where you come across as being kind and considerate to all. So we go back to Romans 12. And in the scriptures we're going to look at here in these verses, these are all personal humility traits. All personal humility traits that we have to choose, that we have to strive for. So let's start in verse 10. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor, giving preference to one another. Very simply stated, but that's what we have to do. Verse 13, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Another characteristic of humility. Verse 15, rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Don't set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble, and don't be wise in your own opinion. I find that what this dean of the Harvard School said in some of his points, you could go back and see these points are lifted here from Scripture. Let's look at verse 17. Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. And if it is possible, as much as depend on you, live peaceably with all men. See, the opposite of peace is war. We don't want to be at war with anyone. We want to be at peace. We have to do everything we can to be at peace with all men. There's a website out there. It's called America Ask Estwick. Strange website. You know, you come across these websites when you go search for things, but this website had actually 20 characteristics of humble people. Now, I'm not going to go through all 20, but I thought, hey, these five are pretty good. In addition to the other 15, they're very, very good points. So let me read some of the, actually five of them, and you could see that they have basis in Scripture. So one is humble people care about the rights of others before themselves. They're thinking about the other people's rights, concern for them. This one is interesting. Humble people do not write or read their own press releases. It's all about me. Now, they don't write or read their own press releases. Humble people treat others with respect, patience, and are peacemakers. RPP. Respect, patience, peacemakers. Humble people, the fourth point here, humble people see their own weaknesses and are readily able to admit to them. They recognize what their weaknesses are, they admit to them, and what do? You go forward. Always try to improve and you go forward. And finally, the last one he had was humble people have a deep, abiding walk with God. And you look what Jesus Christ did, and what we celebrated the other night as a memorial of what Christ did. He was totally humble. And that's the example he set for all of us. Let's look at Philippians 2. Philippians 2, verse 3. Philippians 2 and verse 3. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests. Yes, we need to be concerned about ourselves and things like that, but we also have to be concerned about the interests of others. Let this mind be in you, which was in Christ Jesus. This is a mind of humility. a mindset. The Greek word here for humility or being humble is from a word that properly means having a mindset, of having a deep sense of littleness, of lowliness in mind. Lowliness in mind, that's from Thayer's. And also, Helps Word Study says this, that it's kind of an inside-out virtue, and that we should compare ourselves rather to the Lord versus other people. So this virtue that comes out from us is a comparing ourselves to God versus, you know, other people. It brings our behavior out in avoiding self-exaltation. It helps to avoid being self-inflated. It went on here, it helps Bible Word Study, says, the believer in humility means living in complete dependence on the Lord. Complete dependence on God. So do nothing out of selfish ambition, vain conceit. Remember the interests of others. And it all boils down to having this mindset. Before we conclude, I want to look at one further admonition here in Colossians. So let's go back to Colossians. Just the next book over. Let's look at Colossians 2 and verse 20. Now these things were coming into the church and they were affecting the church brethren. So in verse 20, therefore, if you died with Christ from the basic principles of the world, why, as though living in the world, do you subject yourselves to regulations like do not touch, do not taste, do not handle, which all concern things that perish with the using, according to the commandments and doctrines of men. These things indeed have an appearance of wisdom and self-imposed religion, false humility, and neglect of the body, but are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh. There are self-made religions out there. There are self-made ideas of self-abasement, and you have to have a severe treatment of the self, and it comes across as having a type of humility. Don't get caught up in the Far Eastern types of asceticism. This is what was happening in Colossians, and there are groups out there that get into this asceticism. You can't have any pleasure whatsoever. And you get into all these other type of things of, as it says, you can't eat, you can't touch, you can't handle, which of course, God isn't that way. That is not humility. That's a false humility. That some who get into that think they're okay with it, and it's out there. And it's grabbing the attention of some of our people. And we have to avoid those Far Eastern type of religious ideas. True humility, though, is found in the next chapter. Chapter 3, verse 12. Chapter 3, verse 12. It's almost a reiteration of what we read earlier in Peter and in Philippians and in Romans. Romans 3, verse 12. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, and long-suffering, bearing with one another, forgiving one another, If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection, and let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which you were called in one body, and be thankful. As the elect of God, put on tender mercies. It's like, as we read earlier, we put it on. It is a cloak. It is our garment. We put on this love. We put on this concern. We allow God's peace to dwell in us and to always be thankful. So these are the scriptures. There are many, many others that reveal how we can choose and we can strive for humility. We've got to keep leaven, pride, out of our lives, not only for this week, but for the months and years to come.